Thank you very much. My name is Bob Steele, and I'm chairman of the Aspen Institute Board of Trustees. Thank you. First person to stop clapping was my wife. And it's my great pleasure to welcome all of you to our summer celebration. On behalf of the board and all the team at the Aspen Institute, we'd like to thank you for being here tonight and supporting the Aspen Institute. We would not be what we are without all of your support in being here, and we're all enormously grateful. I'd also like to take a second just to recognize tonight's co-chairs, Jessica Henry Cato and Julia and David Cope.
Hey.
It's their hard work and organization that have made this evening as lovely and as successful as it is, so thank you all very, very much. Tonight's always an exciting celebration, but it's especially meaningful as we celebrate and remember those people whose vision and ideas are the reason for this wonderful organization exists. Certainly all of the trustees are grateful to be part of the celebration, and I'm also inspired in my own role at the Institute by the Pepsi legacy, which we recognize tonight. So now it's my special pleasure to introduce the man who is our own vision and whose ideas are responsible for so much of what we're celebrating and supporting tonight. In the 6 years since he began at the Institute, Walter Isaacson has continually revitalized and invigorated Walter Pepke's 60-year-old legacy for the Institute, breathing a new life and transforming it into a dynamic, exciting institution, which is really setting us straight forward into the 21st century. Ladies and gentlemen, it's really my pleasure on behalf of all of the trustees to introduce you and introduce Walter Isaacson. Walter?
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much, Bob, and one of the great pleasures I have now is working with Bob. And it's also a great pleasure after 60 years to be the backup Walter at the Walter Pepke Celebration. And I really want a few added things. I want to thank Mercedes Bass. She helped us quite a bit as we went through this program this past few weeks, and that was great. And Kitty Boone, who does everything but help put the program on in the tent, along with Asador and Alan Fletcher and others. There's a worrisome thing about birthday parties. When you have a big birthday party, it sounds good, but then a whole lot of family comes. But when the families are the Crown families, the Cato family, and the Pepke family, it's really great to see so many family members. We figured by honoring all three, we could fill up the room without even trying to sell tickets. But it's especially true because these are people we really love. We love Lester and Renee Crown, four generations now from Henry Crown to their 25 grandchildren being part of the Institute. Henry Cato is somebody I've admired so much, and Henry and Jessica, it truly does add new meaning to the word love when I'm just around you all and see you and we all feel that way. And so, thank you. And certainly over the past 2 or 3 years, to get to know the family, the Pepke family, and to deal with various members of it, from Ariane, who did the wonderful necklace. The bidding is still open, I think. If you really want to rush outside, please do so. To the great Pepke sisters who really helped when we were trying to figure out how to renovate the Walter Pepke Memorial Building. And so it's my great pleasure to thank and to introduce the honorary co-chairs tonight, Tony Pepke de Brule. And believe it or not, I think that's she. Is that right? Am I right? No? This one? All right. Amazing. You haven't changed a bit. And Paula Pepke-Zerker right here with their parents. Thank you all so very much.
Somebody said, are you the one with the spots? I thought they meant the little outfit I have on with the polka dots. So I said, yes, they meant the dog. I am not the dog. My father had a horrible sense of humor, and he called the dog who had liver-colored spots Sir Roses. Pronounced cirrhosis if you did it badly. Never mind. Because all of the dog's siblings were known as King Arthur, Merlin, you know, they all had titles. So Sir Roses stuck with him. You all Many of you in this room actually knew my mother, so I'm actually not going to speak about her, though she was obviously very instrumental in everything that Father was able to accomplish out here, and she lived way after he had died at such an early age. And there are many people in this room who were also responsible for making the Institute and the Music School what it is today. And to them, obviously, we give our great thanks. But I'm going to speak about my father, who, after all, died in 1960, and not even my grandchildren had ever seen him, and my own children had not seen him. So that's why I'm going to talk about him. And there has been much written about him, and you are going to see a film tonight where he speaks. I hate to tell you that neither my sister nor I recognized his voice on the movie, because he was originally taped in the 1950s, and the tape was so bad that in order to get anything out of it, Greg Poschman, who is just wonderful, managed to get some voice out of it. So you hear his words, but don't think that is his voice, because it really doesn't sound much like him. The thing that doesn't come through is my father had an incredibly good sense of humor. Some people would say evil, but it was a good sense of humor. And the first time we ever saw Aspen, we came in over Independence Pass. It was a one-lane road with passing places every now and again, and lots of fencing that trailed off down the mountainside where people had gone over. It didn't give you a great feeling of security, actually. And I was not good on hairpin turns, neither was my older sister, so we were sort of green by the time we got over it. And Father stopped in front on the way down, stopped in front of a house that had no door, sort of broken glass windows, half a roof, and he started unloading the luggage off the top of the station wagon, saying, "Daughters, this is your new home." I am told that I burst into tears. I don't know what else happened, but Mother, as Father was loading all the luggage off, said, "Walter, that's enough." And so he began to put the luggage back on. He had stopped in Independence, Colorado, which only had, I think, three buildings standing even then, and he had chosen one of the nicer ones. Father, of course, said, "Well, think how grateful they'll be with whatever we show them from now on in." My father was never one to say, "Oh, no, that was a bad thing to do." No, no, just forge ahead. Anyway, he was probably right, because when we moved into Pioneer Park, it had a foot pedal organ in the front parlor. If you trod on it, it didn't make a sound that you would like. It sort of wailed at you, and moths and dust just flew out of it. I mean, the whole house was sort of like that. And at the top of the stairs, which faced the front door, there was a toilet on a platform. So it meant that if you were coming up the stairs, you could see the knees to the feet of whoever was sitting on the toilet at the top of the stairs. It was a remarkable house. Now, Bob Hutchins said that my father was the most tiresome man he ever met. And I think what he meant by that was most persistent, most single-minded, most driven. If he got an idea, you just could not turn him away. He was even that way in the house. I remember Father coming home one day and saying, "Has there been any phone calls for me?" I said, "No, Father, none." "Are you sure?" "Yes, Father, I'm sure." "Did you go out?" "No, I did not go." I mean, it's like, you know, the crime stories we see. "No, I did not go out. I've been here all afternoon." 3 minutes later, I could hear him downstairs saying, "Paula, were there any phone calls for me?" But that was what he was like. I mean, you know, determined. Anyway, another story about my father, which sort of shows that he did not like to apologize much. He took my sister Nina to dinner before the concert in Chicago, and there was a very nice young man who'd been dragged in, poor thing, to be Nina's escort for the evening. And Father referred to him as George all evening, and Nina kept sort of tugging at Father and saying, "You know, his name is Roger." Well, finally, it came time to leave the table, and Nina, who was so embarrassed she thought she was going to die, said, "Father, his name is Roger." Father said, "Do you know Roger? You know, George, I've never cared much for the name Roger. Do you mind if I continue to call you George? And he did. And this poor benighted man told this story to my husband, who was a business friend of his, and we knew that story was true. You know, sometimes you hear stories about your parents and you think, oh no, I'm not sure about that one. But that one we really knew. The last thing I'm gonna say is, which is a silly story too, is that my father had a chauffeur at Container Corporation. No other member of the Container Corporation staff would ever drive with Richard. Richard was the world's worst driver. We did not know why Father loved Richard so, but Richard wrote poetry and would recite it to you, but he did not drive well at all, not at all. And he was about this tall, and Father referred to him as Richard the Lionheart, because he would pick up these vast suitcases and trundle off with them. Anyway, one day, Paula was in the car, and some man went and made a left turn out of a right lane, cutting right across Richard. And Father was furious at Richard, who ran into the man. And Paula said, but why were you so mad at him? And Father said, well, that's the way Richard always makes left-hand turns. I thought he'd know. Now, you may think that people like my father, that the people who worked for him would not have liked him much. But all I can tell you is that when my father died, we got a letter from Richard's daughter that said that she was sure that when her father went to heaven, if my father ever needed a lift, it would be her father driving him. And so that is the father that I would like to toast tonight, and his vision and his stamina and his stick-to-itiveness, which we all loved. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Paula Papke-Zürcher, the older sister. I'm sorry to say that when I was a child, I was a complainer, and I also cried a lot, which actually ended up being a good thing, because before he died, my father gave me a wonderful drawing by Paul Klee called Die Träne, which was the picture of a young girl with a single tear rolling down her cheek. So I, in retrospect, I wasn't so sorry that I had been a crybaby. But I remember one time when I complained to my father and I said, my sister Nina is the eldest, my sister Toni is the youngest, and what am I? I'm nothing. I'm nothing but a nothing. And he said, nonsense, you're the middlest. And I said, well, what do you do if you're the middlest? And he said, you just try to be the very best middlest that you can be. I very soon discovered that to be the eldest is not such a great thing after all. And all of you who are the eldest in your families will know, I think, what I mean. Your parents are experimenting on you. Face it, they have never had a child before you. And so it's trial and error all the time. Sometimes it turns out all right, as with my sister Nina, but sometimes, let's face it, it leads to legal action. As for my sister Toni, being the youngest, I found was not that great either. She was continuously being expected to be perfect. The parents had thrown up their hands and said, oh my God, not another one. And what are we going to do with her? And so they figured if they did nothing, she'd be great. She'd just turn out perfect, out of the box, you know. When she wasn't all she was hoped to be, They blamed her for everything. Things would go wrong in the house, and you'd think there was a poltergeist around, but Tony was always to blame for everything. So in the end, I thought, you know, to be the middlest is not bad at all. I was ignored. That was great. So now I find that I'm in the middle again. But this time, I'm between generations. I'm between the generation of my parents, whom you are honoring tonight, and my children and my sister's children, who are the grandchildren. And my mother once said to my son, Chris, who unfortunately is not able to be with us tonight, she said to him, and he was a biochemist who had been working in genetics for some time. She turned to him and she said, Chris, you know, you get many more genes from your grandparents than you do from your parents. And my son, Chris, being smart enough to know that my mother was a person with whom you did not disagree, said, oh, yes, and that is because? And she said, well, it's simple. You just count them. You have four grandparents. You only have two parents. So moving along on that basis, which I admit requires a leap of faith, this is not something that can be tested scientifically, I would like tonight to honor the grandchildren. And so with the light shining up there, I can't see exactly where you're sitting, but I think that's my niece, Alexandra. So to Alexandra, her sister Amanda could not be with her. To my son, Andrew, to my daughters, Tony and Ariane, and to my nephew and niece, Nicholas and Jennifer, I have this to say. Don't worry about following in somebody else's footsteps. Don't worry about somebody else's expectations for you. Go for what really fires you up, what you enjoy, what you love. Follow your dreams and your visions and pick your own mountain. Everybody wants to be at the top of the mountain, but the growth and the happiness occur while climbing it. So remember that if along the way you see any need, satisfy it. You see any opportunity, grab hold of it. Because this is the last time that you will walk that particular path. And on the way too, remember to stimulate your minds, feed and exercise your body, and nourish your spirit. So tonight, I would like to toast the grandchildren, and not just these grandchildren, but all of your grandchildren, including the 25 grandchildren of the crowns, and all grandchildren everywhere, because it is in their hands that the future lies.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention, please? We're about to start our film presentation.
physician and missionary doctor in Equatorial Africa, one of the great humanitarians of our time. José Ortega y Gasset, preeminent Spanish philosopher, who led intellectual rebellions against dictators and kings. Robert Maynard Hutchins, president of the University of Chicago, a humanist who sought to create world unity at the dawn of the atomic age. These three were part of a movement advocating the revival of humanism after the horrors of World War II. They would be brought together by Chicago and industrialists,